Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judakin. With me today is artist Dred Scott, who first incited national debate in the late 1980s with his installation, What is the Proper Way to Display a U.S. Flag? It was derided by President George W. Bush and eventually found its way into a Supreme Court case. Dred Scott's most recent controversy was sparked by another flag, flying over a new show in New York that reads, A man was lynched by police yesterday, in stark block letters. Dred Scott will be in Memphis on September 8th for a public lecture at Rhodes College titled The Impossibility of Freedom in a Country Founded on Slavery and Genocide. His work will be showcased in the exhibit at Clough Hansen Gallery, The Weight of Hope, which opens September 9th. Here to talk with me about his art and politics in the age of Black Lives Matter is Dred Scott. Welcome to Counterpoint.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for having me on. I'm looking forward to talking today.
So by way of introduction, can you tell us about your name? Why Dred Scott?
I mean, there's a deep reason and a simple reason. I mean, I chose the name. It's my professional name. When I was in my 20s and I was a student at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and I was also part of the punk scene, and you know, I had friends that were in bands, and you know, all those guys had various stage names. I knew a cat named Virus X. There were other bands with people that had other names, and I figured, well, even though I'm a visual artist, I should have a different name. So I was thinking, well, what name would be good? And I had dreadlocks at the time, and all the cats that I knew that had dreads, you know, were Steve Dredd or Jimmy Dredd or something like that. And my parents named me Scott, and I'm like, wait, I'll be Dred Scott. That's brilliant. And so, you know, obviously there's a pun in there, and obviously there's the dreadlocks, but really I was thinking about the 1857 Supreme Court decision, which ruled in part there are no rights that a black person has that a white man is bound to respect. You know, that was a line written by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Roger Taney, at the time. The ruling was something that actually, I think, says a lot and concentrates a lot about America. And while, you know, I knew at the time black people were not outright owned as chattel slaves, I thought that the basic social relations between the descendants of the enslaved and the descendants of slave owners was basically the same. And I wanted people, when they talked about me and talked to me, you know, actually remembered that history. And, you know, since, you know, my young days when I was, you know, thinking of kind of clever puns or something like that, I've gone on to actually study and read the case a little bit more. And it is actually the document that Taney wrote, which was not just a Supreme Court decision. It was that, but it was also then published as a book. But it's the most well-thought-out, articulated argument for white supremacy I've ever read in my life. And it's deeply rooted in the U.S. Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and U.S. law and British law and custom up till that point. And so, you know, I think that obviously I'm not a proponent of white supremacy, but I do think that people should really read that document because in a certain sense, I think that, you know, Taney had a point that the founding fathers had no intention of thinking as the people that they enslaved as human beings or as citizens. And that sets a lot of the context for what America was then, but also what it continues to be to this day.
Well, I do think that it is really a brilliant name. It's a wonderful sort of artistic statement that signs all of your statements because it indicates the perspective from which you speak, which is in that name, Dred Scott, speaking in the name of Dred Scott. But there is a difference, and the pun we can't hear on the radio, which is that you spell it differently. You have an A in your name. It spells the word dread in the sense of fear and apprehension. What about that aspect of your name?
That was definitely part of it as well. And, you know, I actually like the idea that in the eyes of some, my name and my persona and my art strikes fear. You know, I think that's actually a really important aspect. And I did intentionally spell the name differently than the historic figure who was just Dred Scott. And, you know, I did want to take that up. And I also wanted to sort of roll in the concept of dread as in, you know, Rastafarianism. I was not a Rasta and I'm an atheist and but I do think that a lot of the Rastas had a concept of dread, both dreadlocks, but also fear, that the word had different nuance and meaning. And I really wanted to kind of connect with and resonate with that as well.
And to thread it into your sort of revolutionary approach to art, I mean, there's also the sense of alienation in the word dread, which I love as well. Roll us back a little bit to kind of your upbringing, how you came to do the art that you do. Tell us a little bit about that.
I grew up in the city of Chicago, which is a really segregated city. I grew up on the South Side to middle-class parents. And Chicago, well, first off, I was sort of the first generation, the first sizable generation of Black middle-class kids. And my parents, you know, wanted me to have the opportunities they didn't have, so they sent me to an elite private school. So I, you know, I got a quote-unquote good education, whatever that really means. And yet I was growing up in this context where I'd travel from, you know, my quote-unquote nice neighborhood on the South Side of Chicago. And I'd often go quite literally through housing projects. And at the time, about 10% of the Black population of the city and 5% of the population as a whole lived in house, you know, public housing. I mean, the housing projects in Chicago were just huge. And so I'd go from there, from, you know, the South Side, which was a nice middle class neighborhood, through the housing projects to this elite private school. And so that really sort of, you know, made an impression on me, seeing this profound contrast in sort of life experience and wealth. And then also, I grew up at the time of Ronald Reagan. I mean, you know, I jokingly tell people that Ronald Reagan made me a communist. But growing up in Reagan's America, it was, you know, it was a time of just unbridled, you know, American vengeance on the world and profound greed at home. And if you couldn't fit in with that, if you couldn't get with that, then you were going to have problems. And I had problems. I didn't, you know, it's like I was just a kid. I wasn't thinking in grand political terms at the time. I wasn't really trying to analyze all of what was going on. But I know I didn't fit into either the school that I was at, the people that I was going to school with, by and large, or the society more broadly. I mean, you could look and you could see that there was, you know, leaders on either side of an ocean, both the Soviet Union and the United States, that were threatening to destroy the world to expand their empire. And that seemed absolutely crazy to me. And, you know, so I ended up connecting and getting into punk rock, which was a very alienated section of youth who all, you know, couldn't fit in for some reason. And, you know, with a little bit of hindsight, it's like, well, actually, we were the sane ones, and the inmates were running the asylum. And so that sets a lot of the stage for kind of how I became who I was as a person. And then getting into art was actually really an accident. I was, you know, if you had known me when I was 16 or 15, 16, 17, you would have thought, and I would have told you, I'm probably going to be some sort of scientist, maybe a computer scientist or a chemical engineer. But I ended up doing kind of badly the last year and a half of school, and I couldn't get into Caltech or MIT or anything like that. In fact, I failed out of school. Didn't, you know, I was a couple credits shy of graduating, and I could have gone back, but I just didn't want to. I mean, I couldn't, you know, I felt my sentence was up. I had done my time. I had to get out. And so my parents asked me, look, what do you want to do with your life if you don't have a, you know, high school diploma, what are you going to do? I said, I'll be a photographer. And I grew up around cameras because before I was born, my dad was a professional photographer. And then he became a serious amateur photographer. So I said, I'll be a photographer. And they asked all their friends, anybody who knew photographers. So I got to meet fashion photographers. I got to meet photojournalists. I got to meet, you know, just commercial photographers doing any sort of work. And one of them said, go to the School of the Art Institute, take some classes there. They'll teach you to be a photographer. And I was like, oh, you mean that boring place that I got dragged to once a year that had boring old art on the wall? And he said, yeah, they'll teach you to be a photographer. And so I took that advice and I just sort of bogarted my way into taking some classes. And, you know, I sort of fell in love with it. I didn't know that much about art going into it, but I, you know, both embraced the photography that I was learning, but art more generally through art history classes. And that sort of shaped the framework within which this combination of being sort of alienated from Reagan's America and looking to rebel and find a way to do that then got shaped through some of the art that I was doing at the time.
And it was already while you were there at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago that you jump onto the national stage with this piece, What is the Proper Way to Display a U.S. Flag? Describe how that piece came about, how it was staged as an installation and the response to it.
The piece, you know, is sort of a simple piece on a certain level. I say it's an installation for audience participation and that it's a conceptual artwork, but it's actually really pretty simple. There's a photomontage on the wall that was about 20 inches by 16 inches, and it had text that said, what's the proper way to display a U.S. flag? And below that was an image of South Korean students burning U.S. flags, holding signs that said, Yankee, go home, son of a bitch. and below them was flag-draped coffins coming back from Vietnam and a troop transport. Then attached to the wall below the photo montage was a shelf that had books on it that were originally blank that people could write responses to the question, what's the proper way to display a U.S. flag? And then on the floor was a 3x5-foot flag that people had the option of standing on when they interacted with the work and wrote responses to the question. And so the work came about. I was at the time really trying to figure out how to I'd become a revolutionary at that point, and I was really trying to figure out how do you make art that talks about people's hopes and aspirations and really concentrates a lot of the contradictions that are sort of defining of this society. And, I didn't have a lot of example. I was looking at people. And then when I discovered an artist named Hans Hacke, who was a sort of a radical conceptual artist, I said, oh, wait, this is how to do it. Now, Hans wasn't mostly trying to connect with the people that are most sort of messed over and oppressed and exploited in this society, which I was trying to do that. I was already going into housing projects, trying to learn from people's experience, trying to sell revolutionary newspapers in the housing projects, and trying to, build, with other revolutionaries, a movement for revolution. So I was really trying to connect with the people, but I was still trying to make fine art that I was principally going to show in galleries and museums. And so I made this artwork, which, again, was very simple, that enabled people to talk about what U.S. patriotism represented. It wasn't just my view of the flag, but it allowed people who, are the victims of this society to have equal footing to talk about what the flag means to them as people who, uphold it. And so the piece, was first displayed at a show, an exhibition in Chicago, and it was seen by, several hundred people, including city council people, and there was no issue or controversy about it. But then when it was shown at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, it became a huge national controversy that, it got to the point where President George Herbert Walker Bush won, publicly called the work disgraceful. The Congress ended up passing legislation which would effectively outlaw the work. There were demonstrations for and against the work, including demonstrations of 2,500 reactionary veterans, almost all from the Korean War and World War II, and almost all white, who chanted, "The flag and the artists, hang them both high," bringing back images of lynching. And, the school got bomb threats and death threats. The school was closed down for a couple of days. There were, newspaper articles, sometimes five in one day in each of the two main newspapers in Chicago at the time. This was a very big deal. I could talk about the significance of what does it mean when the Congress actually, outlaws an artwork and why it was necessary to burn flags on the steps of the Capitol to defy that. But the simple answer was there was, some powerful forces that wanted this work suppressed. And then there was people that were waiting in line for up to an hour to see the show, many of whom had, very interesting contemplative thoughts that they wrote into the books, and some who would call into talk radio programs from the housing projects and the ghettos and barrios, both in Chicago but as far away as Texas and California, that talked about what the work meant to them and why they both united with it politically. But those who actually saw it in Chicago were also giving, art criticism, which was really interesting, that people that, normally are shut out of working with ideas in a lot of ways had some actually really interesting thoughts about how this sort of very contemporary artwork was resonating with them and how it worked as art.
Now, when you talk about burning flags on the steps of the Capitol, listeners may not know that that's what you did in response to the outrage that the piece provoked. The most recent flag, the flag "A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday," also brings back images of lynching, which you just mentioned. You actually rework a flag that was flown in 1936 by the NAACP that read, "A man was lynched yesterday," created in response to a lynching in Georgia. One recurring theme in your work is to weave images from the past into the present in order to highlight not only how the past conditions the present, but actually resides in the present in a new form. Can you talk about that theme with respect to the flag?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, it's that concept of looking how the past both sets the stage for the present but resides in the present in new form is a theme that's been pretty consistent in my work now for a couple decades. And I think that, I think both aspects are important. I think many people in this society aren't really trained to think of history as having a continuum, that one society inherits the all the conditions from the society previous to it. And I don't just mean, you know, America inherited stuff from England, but, you know, this generation inherits from the previous generation. And people often think of things sort of history ripped out of context, and there is that continuum. But, you know, particularly looking at lynching, by and large, black people are not lynched today in America. I mean, it happens, but it's pretty rare. And in the, you know, 1920s and 1910s, 1870s, 1880s, 1940s, it was actually common. I mean, I think the statistics are about that there was, you know, between 1865 and 1965, there were about 4,500 lynchings or something like that. And, you know, the first time there was not a public lynching in the United States from the 1860s was 1948, I think. So lynching was a very public terror that was, you know, perpetrated against the black community. And while, you know, black people by and large, most of us weren't lynched, but everybody knew that for any reason or no reason whatsoever that you could be in the South, but also in the North. There were lynchings that happened outside of Minneapolis and Duluth, Minnesota. There were lynchings that happened all over the United States. And it was, you know, for things like, you know, owning property, joining a union, whistling at a white woman, not stepping off the curb when a white person passed by, being in the, you know, fitting the description of somebody that somebody else was mad at. I mean, lynching could happen for no reason whatsoever. The police were and sheriffs were often culpable in facilitating the lynchings. They were, you know, advertised, and sometimes people would, you know, 20,000 people would come from neighboring towns to watch a lynching. And, you know, the perpetrators of these crimes were never brought to justice, even though everybody in the towns knew who did it. There were photographic evidence, which, you know, then got turned into often postcards to be sent to, you know, people in the black community, both in that town but also neighboring communities, as a threat of what would happen, how they would be treated in the town where the lynchings happened. And the lynchers would, like, cut off body parts of the people they lynched, and basically you would go to your local convenience store or your dime store, and you'd find an arm, or, you know, an ear or a finger or a nose or a toe in, you know, in a jar sitting on the counter. I mean, it was really disgusting, but it really concentrated a lot of, you know, that period of American history. That mostly doesn't happen now. But you do have the situation where all parents, all black and Latino parents, have a talk with their kid about how to survive an encounter with the police now. And even the mayor of New York, who has a black son, has said, I've had the talk with my kid. What does that mean when, you know, you see these videotapes, you see the videotapes of, you know, the murder of Alton Sterling or Philando Castile or Eric Garner or Walter Scott, and you know that, or Freddie Gray, and Freddie Gray is a great example. I mean, everybody knows that Freddie Gray was a perfectly healthy young man before he encountered the police in Baltimore. He was, you know, sort of hogtied and thrown in the back of a police van in excruciating pain. The only people who had any encounter with him were the police. He's dead a week later. And then this system puts the cops on trial, and all of them are either let off, acquitted, or they decide to throw out all the charges. And so this is the situation where black people today face. It's the same as lynch mob terror, you know, 40, 50, 70, 80, 100 years ago, but it's the police, paid agents of the government, who were, you know, committing murder upon murder upon murder upon murder and getting away with it again and again and again, despite the fact that there's videotaped evidence, despite the fact that there are witnesses, despite the fact that people know what happened. This is a you know, a form of terror that happens to the black community. And so I made this artwork to talk about that parallel, but also the parallel of resistance, because the NAACP was actually fighting an anti-lynching campaign where they were trying to stop lynching and stop that from happening and mobilizing people. So they flew this flag in their New York headquarters whenever anybody was lynched, anybody anywhere around the country, to try and organize people to stop this scourge. And now this scourge exists in new form in the 21st century, where we get to see a four-year-old girl try to comfort her mother as her boyfriend bleeds to death in the car seat next to her, being shot by a cop, following the orders of the cop to hand him his wallet.
It's such powerful stuff. And obviously from Memphis, Ida B. Wells is a local hero of the city who had to leave because of the history of lynching. And where did she go? To Chicago. And you're continuing that tradition. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin, in conversation today with artist Dred Scott, who will be in Memphis September 8th for a public lecture at Rhodes College, and whose work will be featured in the new exhibit at the Clough Hansen Gallery, opening September 9th. You've repeatedly highlighted issues of mass incarceration, racial profiling, and the identity of Blacks and Hispanics as criminals in your art, or rather the criminalization of those groups. After Michael Brown was killed, Dredd, you tweeted a screen print image called Sign of the Times, reminiscent of a traffic sign that reads, "Danger, police in area," that was originally made following the shooting of Amadou Diallo. What I want to ask you is, how does your art resonate with the politics of the Black Lives Movement? Or really, to put it another way, what is the role of art and artists in movements like Black Lives Matter?
I think that's a very important question, and people really, all sorts of people, including a lot of artists, really need to think about that, because we are seeing, with the Black Lives Matter movement, which is, both has actual organization but is broader than that, people who do not, people who want to stop the police from killing our youth, but also mass incarceration and things like that. I've worked with a lot of these themes because the conditions of race in America, the situation that Black people and Latinos face, if you look at that question, it's not the only thing wrong with America by any stretch of the imagination. But you look at both, you go back to the Constitution, where, this country was giving disproportionate representation on the federal level to states that had, lots of people that owned other human beings. The 3/5 of a man is actually about that representation for owning one form of property, but not all forms of property. And so you get a lot, you can understand a lot about America, both the problems from its inception and how systemic racism is by looking at the conditions of Black people and Latinos, but also the potential for radical change by looking at that question as well. So I've spent a lot of time looking at that. And, the Danger, Police, and Area is both a fine art print that actually is owned by the Whitney Museum and other individuals and institutions, but it's also something that appears on T-shirts. My work, shows in major museums, but also on street corners, sometimes with permission and sometimes without. And I really am trying to connect with a range of people and make my work for a range of people. So when movements like, Black Lives Matter, again, which is broader than just the movement for Black Lives, the organization that's sort of, and the people that coined the term, it's a movement of people who want to stop the police from, killing our youth and warehousing our youth in prisons and jails, and have risked a lot. It's the most powerful sort of movement for justice in this country in the past 40 years, during my adult lifetime. And it's really wonderful. And I think it's really important that artists do respond to this, and artists, both visual artists, but, musicians and filmmakers, and both use our art to talk about this so people can understand this better, but also to use our public voice. And, we're sitting in an interesting time where artists like, filmmaker Quentin Tarantino, about a year ago, year and a half ago, marched with family members of people who were killed by the police. There was a march in New York that had 100 people, family members, of who'd lost loved ones, who had their loved ones' lives stolen by the police. And this was a demonstration to stop that. And Quentin Tarantino is a very well-respected, well-made, well-known filmmaker, marched with these family members, and that was really great. There are, other artists that have, it's like, 3 years ago, you wouldn't have predicted that Beyoncé would be at the Super Bowl actually making a giant X and actually at the center of some controversy around that with the sort of costumes that look like the Black Panther Party. And it's not just sort of, artists, athletes are, in the mix. Carmelo Anthony, a very high-profile basketball player, has sent an important Instagram message that has rallied a lot of other athletes to say, people have to be willing to step up in the spirit of Muhammad Ali, which is, I think, a really righteous example, and he's got a lot of support and following. There are artists like Kendrick Lamar who are, at I think it was the Grammys, did a very, poignant performance that talked about the conditions of mass incarceration. And then you've got people like, I'm suddenly forgetting the brother's name, who was on the BET Awards, that gave a really powerful speech. But artists are using their public voice and they're using their art. And that's why this, a man was lynched by police yesterday, and the Sign of the Times piece with the hands, police shooting a stick figure of a person with their hands up, that's a Danger, Police, and Area, are really important to talk about what's going on with both the sort of the slow genocide that's being perpetrated on the black community, but also the possibility for the people who are the targets of that sort of repression and mass incarceration and brutality to be agents of change and potentially revolutionaries that could, you know, upend this whole system and help humanity get to an era where they don't have a society that needs police to enforce relations of exploitation and oppression.
You spoke a little bit about Beyoncé and Tarantino, singers, directors, all kinds of artists helping to sort of galvanize the movement. I just want to push a little bit deeper, though, on the question of how it is that visual artists, fine art, the kind of art that's exhibited in museums like your work is, I mean, is there something different about the genres in which you work and what they can contribute to Black Lives Matter? Or is it really just a kind of spectrum of responses that you're hoping people will use as a way to help push this movement forward?
Well, I think mostly it is a spectrum of responses, but I do think there is something a little bit different about the visual arts. I mean, there have been two shows which I think have been important recently, each of which I was involved with. The first was a show called Respond, which was a show at an alternative gallery in Brooklyn, New York, at a place called Smack Melon, which is a wonderful place. And they, in addition to having a big gallery, they also have an artist residency. And so I and six other people had a year-long time when we had a studio space there. And when the non-indictments of the killers of Mike Brown and Eric Garner came out, the director of the program asked me and then asked all the other residents whether we would, you know, be willing to help sort of bring together or curate a show that responds to these non-indictments and do it in a month's time, which would mean that the gallery would have to change their schedule. They'd have to ask the artists who were planning on showing in that month to change their slot, and then to, you know, quickly move heaven and earth to get a bunch of art into there. And so the six of us plus the gallery staff organized the show in a month's time, which is unheard of. Normally, a show, you know, any show would take, you know, months to prepare and plan out and schedule. And certainly a show that ended up having about 200 artists in it out of applications by I think maybe 500 or something like that. Lots of artists, from people who are, you know, even still in high school, to artists who were very, very successful artists, wanted to participate in this. And it became a platform for all sorts of people to sort of, you know, contribute as peers and as equals to this conversation about how the police are treating people and how they are getting away with murder and what should we do about it. And so there was both the collective coming together that then had lots of programs that were attached to it that were, you know, there were film screenings of sometimes avant-garde films. There were, you know, dialogues with sort of radical activists that were in the gallery, which is also unusual. There was meditation classes. There was a self-defense class as a conceptual artwork about, you know, how to protect yourself if you're being choked to death. That was one important show, and one of the things about fine art – now, this was made comparatively quickly, but a lot of times if you are a popular musician or a popular filmmaker, you've got a whole – both a process. I mean, films take, you know, a couple years to – you know, from the time a script is written to the time it hits the Hollywood screen, it takes, you know, often a couple years. But also there's a lot of people who have hands in it, including – a lot of people with deep pockets that are trying to influence something because they're trying to make profit on it. And often visual artists aren't – they don't have those restrictions, and so we can both make work that, you know, is potentially more challenging politically, but also, you know, it's a medium in which there – it's non-linear. Visual art is an inherently non-linear conversation. And an audience member has to bring a lot of themselves to it. So if the art is good, it opens up space for people to have sort of a different understanding of the world than often you'll get with something like a film or a song, which, you know, are often narrative and, you know, A happens, then B happens, then C happens. And with visual art, it just doesn't work that way. So I do think that there's this continuum. I think there's a way it connects to sort of people, but there is this visual art is a different realm, and it's part of what I really like about it. It's one of the few areas of society where there's that form of human dialogue and discourse that's not linear. And then the other show I was talking about is a show that happened recently, which was a show at Jack Shainman Gallery called Four Freedoms, which was – Four Freedoms is technically a super PAC. A couple artists, Eric Gottsman and Hank Willis Thomas, formed a legal super PAC to enable artists to sort of – have conversations about the moment. They wanted to get subway ads and things, and not so much having artists talk about advocating for one or another candidate, but talking about a lot of issues that often the candidates aren't talking about or are talking about in a way that would sort of not really be helpful, but more would be useful to get votes, where artists had the freedom to just say, well, we want to talk about these ideas. And so this show, this is an art show that comes out of this super PAC. But it brought together a lot of very, very well-known, successful artists that have been known, have a long history of doing work that talks about the world we live in deep and complex ways. And it's also at a gallery that's a very, very respected gallery. Now, I was part of this show and I have a couple different pieces in it. But when the videotapes came out of the killing of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, I quickly said, look, can we add a work to the show? The show had already been up for a couple weeks, actually. And I talked to Hank Willis Thomas. I said, can we add one work? And expecting that the answer would be no. Typically, when a show in a commercial gallery is curated, the work's on the wall. That's it. But they, you know, he contacted the gallery and the gallery contacted me and said, how quickly can you get here? Hop in a cab, bring the flag. We want to put it up. And, you know, it was because of both the urgency of the moment, but also the visibility of this particular gallery and this particular show with this particular grouping of artists talking about this range of questions that people should be thinking about at the moment of an election, that enabled this work, A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday, to actually get onto the national stage to the point where the New York Times has written three articles that have mentioned it, including one very substantive article about artistic responses to recent police murders that was for a while featured on the front page of the NewYorkTimes.com and then has been reproduced in their print edition in really great ways.
So let's localize that a little bit. The Weight of Hope show that's going to be at the Clough Hansen Gallery is about art and politics. What are some of the pieces that you're exhibiting there, and how do they speak to this moment?
Well, the two key pieces, or I should say, the two pieces are definitely going to be there, which we plan, you know, been planning for a couple months. Or one is a piece called On the Impossibility of Freedom in a Country Founded on Slavery and Genocide, which was a performance and is now documentation or still photographs that have come out of that performance. And that performance, I sort of it referenced the fire hosing of civil rights demonstrators in 1963 by Bull Connor, civil rights demonstrators who were trying to end Jim Crow segregation. And so Bull Connor, the police chief at the time, you know, that in Birmingham, turned fire hoses on people who were fighting to end systemic racism. And when looking at those photographs, you know, everybody sees, oh, these are really about oppression and the viciousness of the government to turn fire hoses that, you know, could potentially maim people on civil rights activists and particularly young kids. But the thing is that at that time, you know, Jim Crow was both, you know, the daily insult of where you couldn't drink water at a water fountain or where you couldn't sit down at a lunch counter or you couldn't enter the front door of a restaurant or an establishment, but it also was lynching. And so this weight of oppression, I mean, a white person could do just about anything to a black person and get away with it. And so these people were fighting against that and they had the courage to do that. They were resisting that. So the photographs are really photographs of resistance. So I did a performance where I walked into a water jet from a fire hose. I work with firemen and they turned a fire hose on me. And instead of doing what you should do, of fleeing it, I did a durational performance where I was continually in sort of a Sisyphusian effort trying to walk forward into this battering water jet. And sometimes I was knocked down. Often I was just walking into the water. And so there are photographs of that performance. There are a couple. And then there's another performance I did called I Am Not a Man, which, you know, people in Memphis will clearly remember the I Am a Man protest, the sanitation workers' struggle in 1968, where people demanded to be treated like human beings. These sanitation workers both wanted fair wages, but they more than anything wanted to be viewed as and treated like human beings. And so they, you know, for a month they were walking down the streets of Memphis bearing signs that said, "I am a man," and those have become quite iconic photographs. But in 2009, you know, at the time when everybody was saying that America had entered a post-racial era, Barack Obama was president, I knew that this was still America, that systemic and entrenched racism and white supremacy still existed and were defining of this society. And so I did a performance where I walked across the streets of Harlem from 125th from the west side to the east side and back again, carrying a sign that said, "I am not a man," and dressed in sort of 60s. And I was in basically a suit and a tie, much like some of the sanitation workers were, but a lot of people, you know, in protests were dressed that way at the time. And so I walked and I both carried the sign and sometimes acted out some of the degrading and humiliating things that are defining of life for black people in America. Sometimes I had my hands up, sometimes I had my pockets out, sometimes I was crawling on the ground. And, you know, the photographs that have documented that work, I mean, the piece was very important for the people who saw it live, like, you know, on the impossibility of freedom in a country founded on slavery and genocide. There was a live component that was very important. But the way that most people know the work is through the documentation. And in this case, the documentation of, you know, "I Am Not a Man" actually really captures a lot of the performance and their various juxtapositions that you see in these artworks. And one of the things is that there's an encounter with police. And a while back, a friend of mine said, you know, "Man, Dredd, you know, it's like most artists need galleries and agents. You need lawyers." And it is true that a lot of my work, I've had various encounters with various branches of government, including often the police. And so the police were outraged that I was doing this performance. And, you know, so they want the right to degrade and humiliate black people, but they don't want us to be able to talk about it and make art about it. And so you see a photograph where there's that encounter. And then one other piece that we're talking about bringing down, I don't know whether it's going to work out, is we want to see if it's possible to bring a copy of "A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday." I don't know whether that'll happen, but we're in conversation about it. There are a lot of complex issues, but I'm hoping to work it out.
Well, it's going to be great to see these pieces and your pieces as well, interspersed with the works from other artists, local Memphis artists as well, that Joel Parsons is bringing together. Very excited about that. So your work's obviously about race in America today, but you understand that in terms of structural inequalities produced by capitalism. You explore this very directly in a performance you did on Wall Street in 2010, where the placard you wear this time is U.S. currency that you then proceeded to burn. Your piece was titled "Money to Burn." This is part of a series that you've done called "It's the Economy, Stupid." You've said, "This is a world where a tiny handful controls the great wealth and knowledge humanity as a whole has created. It does not have to be this way, and my art is part of forging a radically different future." How does art help create that future?
Well, I think it creates it in two ways. One is people need to confront the world the way it is. And I think, you know, with a piece like "Money to Burn," it actually, you know, it was enacted on Wall Street in front of the stock exchange, and I was singing a song, "Money to Burn," encouraging people that had money to burn to add theirs to the pyre as I burned a bill at a time, fives, tens, twenties, and singles. And, you know, the people with money to burn were very outraged by this piece, whereas the guys that were the delivery guys, the tourists, the just ordinary people on the streets often did add theirs. They actually got that there was a deep problem in a society where at the push of a button, billions of dollars can be moved around the globe and were things that people need, houses and food. And houses can evaporate and food can be, you know, price could be reset so that even though there's plenty of food, people can't afford to eat. And so works like that make people – and, you know, this was a piece that was done before Occupy Wall Street, and it actually – I'm far not saying I was a harbinger of Occupy Wall Street or created Occupy Wall Street. That's not my point. But it does actually get people to think about some of these questions that people, I think – you know, people often say that my works sometimes articulate what they thought but they didn't know they were thinking. And so there is a point where there's I have some confidence that there's a section of my audience that, you know, is kind of with me already. And that's the people I'm reaching for, the people that are, you know, think a lot of these same thoughts but wouldn't quite say it the same way. That, like, "The Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday," many people, that connected and resonated deeply because it was sort of people's experience, but they wouldn't quite phrase it, that there was this horror from the past that was terrorizing us in the present. And it was like, oh, wait, that is actually what's going on. And so Money to Burn resonated in that way. And I think art that can get people to think about and confront the present is very important. And I also think another area and aspect of art is it opens up people's imaginations to think how the world could be. And so, you know, if you're destroying money on Wall Street, the one thing you're not supposed to do with money is destroy it, then what does that open up for people to think? If you actually are, you know, getting to the heart of capitalism and saying that's the problem that we're confronting, well, then what social system, what social structures, what economy do we actually need? Does it open up if we get rid of capitalism? What does that open up? Now, I'm a revolutionary. I'm a communist. I actually think that the new communism that's been envisioned by Bob Avakian, who's the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, it's now viable and desirable. It's not like let's move back to the Soviet Union in 1930 or even China in 1970. It's actually let's, you know, build on the best of this experience from the past, but actually get to a world that does not have classes, without exploitation and without oppression. And I think that the art can actually sort of talk about and raise questions like that. Art, you know, is not a revolution, but there hasn't been any revolution or fundamental social change without art being part of it. And it also can open up the imaginations of people to dream in ways that they haven't dreamt before and to look at questions and ask questions that they otherwise wouldn't be asking. And so my art, I think, you know, often raises quite a lot of my art titles are questions or pose questions. And, you know, I think that, you know, I do think I have some answers, but a lot I'm trying to like shine a light on some profound contradictions and of this society and enable people to dream of a world they'd actually want to live in.
Well, Dred Scott, thank you so much for being with us today on Counterpoint, for helping us to confront some of the issues of injustice and also imagine other possibilities, for helping us to link and shrink the connections between slavery and freedom, civil rights and Black Lives Matter, between race and money. We really appreciate you being with us today from the Radio Foundation in New York.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. And you know, I hope that it connects with your audience. This is fantastic.
Dred Scott will be in Memphis at Rhodes College on September 8th at 6 p.m. talking about his art and politics in the age of Black Lives Matter. His artwork will also be highlighted in the new exhibit at the Clough Hansen Gallery, The Weight of Hope, which opens the following night, September 9th. Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.